Okay, well, listen, I hope that this has been a very special experience for you. We've been happy to have you, but without tooting or sameach horn, just the fact that you've been in Israel, that you've been in Jerusalem, that you've kind of had maybe total immersion in the world of Judaism for a while. All of that is very, very important, very significant. As the expression goes, hopefully it's a game changer or a life changer or whatever it is. But, you know, the obvious next question always is, what do you do with inspiration? Now, inspiration is very, very great. In fact, let me draw an interesting Hasidic analogy. All of you, of course, have heard of Chabad, right? Everyone in the world has heard of Chabad. They say there are two things that are available everywhere in the world, and that is Coca-Cola and Chabad. Now, obviously, I'm not here to urge you to go to Chabad. That's not what I'm going to do. But I want to talk about the underlying philosophy of Chabad, because it ties in directly to what we're talking about today. And that is, Chabad is a movement that started 250 years ago. And Chabad is an acronym, it's an abbreviation. Chachma, Bina, Das. Wisdom, understanding, knowledge. The particular differences between them are Kabbalistic, and we don't have to go into them now. But I want to explain why the Rav Schneur Zalman, who is called the Alter Rebbe, the old rabbi, who's really a totally recognized gadol in all circles, why he did what he did. The Hasidic movement was already two generations old by the time he started his version of Hasidus. And Hasidus very much emphasized the concept of emotion, feeling, pattern, that one should not serve God with sterility and lack of enthusiasm, that one cannot just serve God with the mind, one has to serve God with the heart. That's what the Hasidic movement taught, and that's a wonderful thing. But the Alter Rebbe said there was a certain problem with that, as important as that is. And that is, emotions are fleeting. Emotions are ephemeral. Emotions are transient. So you have a great Friday night Karl Bach minyan, right? And you sing and you dance and you really, really, really feel good. But what happens the next morning or even the next hour? Emotions come and go, and therefore he wanted there to be a service of God that was rooted in the mind. That's why it's chachma. But not in the mind in the sense of a disembodied computer that doesn't feel. But rather, he developed the idea that the mind can actually control your feelings as well. It's a very, very unique, revolutionary idea that actually has been taken over by modern psychology. So if people ask the question, is Judaism about the mind or the heart? The answer is yes. We don't consider it in an ultimate sense to be a dichotomy. A person needs to be emotionally connected to God, emotionally connected to Torah. Otherwise, you're just going through the motions. You're just superficial. But it has to be more than just the excitement of nice experiences. It has to be rooted in understanding what it is to be a Jew and getting excited over it and getting passionate over it. But it's rooted ultimately in a person's mind. And that requires knowledge. That requires discipline. It requires hard work. You know, no pain, no gain is as true in Judaism as it is in bodybuilding. The same idea. Good things do not come easy. The only things that come easy are bad things. Bad things come easy. It's easy, you know, to take drugs or alcohol or whatever it would be. That's easy. You know, it doesn't take a big effort to do that. But anything worthwhile in life, whether it's building a career, building a marriage, connecting to God, takes a certain amount of work, you know. So the big issue that all you guys have to face is, you know, this has hopefully been a real, real great experience. But the question is, what do I do to perpetuate this type of good feeling? Now, I understand. You know, Voltaire once said that the best is often the enemy of the better. You get what that means. Often we have a mindset that if I can't do something perfectly, why should I bother? It's not going to be great anyway. In fact, a lot of people, for example, you know, I can take a gazillion examples. Let's say you like to sing, but you don't have the nicest voice. So you're not going to join a choir because, you know, I'm not that good, so people will laugh at me. Or you want to learn a musical instrument. In fact, I once mentioned this in one of the earlier JLEs, and a guy showed me, it was really a serendipitous coincidence. Nothing is a coincidence, really. In which I was talking about the idea that sometimes it's good to be mediocre in the sense that if something is a worthwhile endeavor, go for it, even if you're not going to be super fantastic. So he had a t-shirt that said something like, I'm the best mediocre guitarist, you know, in New York City or something like that. And the point I want to make is this, you know, here you've been in Jerusalem, you've been learning full time, you're going to go back to wherever you come from, and, you know, it's not going to be the same. And a person is tempted to say, you know, if it's not going to be the same, like, what's the use? You know, what's the use of my learning? What's the use of my doing any of that stuff? It's only going to be a tiny fraction of what it was here. So you kind of give up. But that's a big mistake. A wise person once said, this is so interesting, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. Now, all of us know the other way. Anything worth doing is worth doing well. But there's also a certain wisdom. If it's worth doing, you do it, even if it's not going to be perfect, even if it's not going to be great. Something is better than nothing. A half loaf is better than no loaf. Same thing with Shabbos. I'm not going to cross-examine you as to whether you are completely going to keep Shabbos. But I just want to, I hope you do, but I just want to say that if you're not going to keep Shabbos 100%, that doesn't mean there's no value in keeping it 50% or 20% or 10%. If you're going to go out to a movie Friday night, you can still make kiddush and light Shabbos candles, even if you go to the movie. Now again, please don't quote me, right? I always say, go to movies Friday night. I'm not saying that. But all I want to tell you is, don't fall into the fallacy of thinking, if I don't do things 100%, then whatever I do doesn't count. It counts. You know, putting on tefillin every day is a mitzvah that is totally independent of the mitzvah of davening. So, here's the thing. Let's say, again, I'm giving you hypotheticals, and I don't want to encourage you not to do these things, but let's say you feel, based on your schedule, you're not yet ready to daven a whole morning service every day, which might take anywhere from, you know, without a minyan, from 30 to 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's a long service. Okay, but you know, if you put on your tefillin and take them off right away, may take 3 minutes, 5 minutes, you have fulfilled two great mitzvahs of the Torah. So I would tell a person, even if you're not going to die, put on your tefillin. Huh? Two, because there's the hand tefillin and the head tefillin. They are counted as two commandments in the Torah. You see? Which means if you put on the hand and didn't even put on the head, you'd have a mitzvah right there. You see the point I'm making? The point I'm making is Judaism is like a, to some degree, like a Chinese menu or a modular furniture arrangement. On one hand, it's an integrated whole. And of course it is. On the other hand, every piece is valuable. And I think you will find as you go through life, the teaching of our sages, mitzvah gereres mitzvah. This is a very famous statement. One mitzvah causes another mitzvah.
What is a mitzvah?
What is a mitzvah? Oh, the word mitzvah.
No, mitzvah, yeah. What's a...
Gereres, or in Hebrew, modern Hebrew, gereret. Gereres. It rolls into another mitzvah. One mitzvah causes another mitzvah. Because when you do a mitzvah, you get spiritually stronger. You get closer to God. And then you become inspired. Sometimes you look at the whole journey and you say, oh, it's such a big journey, I don't want to start it. One step at a time. What's the famous Chinese saying? A journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. You just take the step. Just take the step. Don't let the best be the enemy of the better. Don't let the idea that I'm not going to be perfect. First of all, perfect. Who's perfect? In spite of what you might think, I'm sure you don't even think that. You know, we are not perfect. I mean, all of us, every religious Jew, we have all sorts of sins and all sorts of imperfections. Hopefully, we try to be better. You know, the mark of a righteous person is not that he doesn't fail. but that when he fails, he gets up again and doesn't allow himself to get discouraged. And that's true for the biggest tzaddik, and that's true for all of us on whatever level we're on. You don't get discouraged. Okay, so this is very, very important. And the reason it's important is because right now you might be on a high, but when you get back into everyday life, things dissipate unless you concretize it with some type of resolution. So specifically, there are different things that you can do. I'm not sure. Are each of you guys? Do each of you guys connected to a mentor? I'm not because JLE doesn't always overlap with the mentors.
This is JLE Connect. We don't necessarily have a mentor.
Because you don't have a mentor. Okay.
We don't.
But since you're JLE Connect, you are generally serious enough. Maybe you don't need a mentor. You're already more committed. Okay. But be it as it may, number one, obviously take advantage of your time here. But when you go back to America, you need to incorporate some type of really daily Torah study. Now, daily Torah study, I don't mean to say, you got to study Torah 10 hours a day, although that would be wonderful. Even if it's as little as, again, I'm trying to be a minimalist here because I want to give you practical things that you can definitely do. If you can do more than this, that's great. But I'm giving you, I think, minimal survival techniques. Even if it's 15 minutes a day, and optimally in two chunks, a day chunk and a night chunk, 15 minutes a day. That's a wonderful thing. That is like life support. That is like oxygen. That is like a power source connecting you to God. Now, what would you study? It could be the Parsha of the week. It could be a practical halacha. It could be a book of Chassidus, something that inspires you. But the most important thing is, it got to be consistent. Consistency is more important than maybe intensity, which is not consistent. Which means 15 minutes a day might actually be better than, an hour every 4 days. Even though that's the same amount of time. But there is a concept of doing it every day that's extremely important. Because every day it becomes part of your routine, it becomes part of your life. Hi, good morning. Now, there are a lot of avenues in which you can link this up. If you can have a face-to-face study companion, a chavrusa, that's good. Have you heard of Partners in Torah? Partners in Torah is very, very excellent. This is a service.
I just signed up.
Oh, okay, great. So you could explain it to people. This is a service which actually arranges telephonic or Skype study partners. And there are people who have been on that arrangement, for years and years and years. Sometimes they still haven't met. Just imagine learning with somebody, a few times a week over 5 years. You know everything about them except how they look. You know their kids and their bar mitzvahs and all these things. And every few years they may have these conventions where they meet. Oh, you're the guy I've been learning with all these years. So Partners in Torah is a wonderful thing. They have a website. You could register. You could actually indicate what you'd like to learn, what you'd like to study. There is the Art Scroll series, which does all the stuff in English. They published a series of books that maybe is less known to people. It's called A Daily Dose of Torah. These are like multi-volumes, and it's broken down by day. Every day it'll give you a little Chumash, a little Mishnah, a little Halacha. It's kind of a composite of different subjects in digestible bites that you can do every day.
How many series is
it? Oh, well, they keep on, they keep on making new ones because they keep on expanding it. But you'll see. Typically, it's the size of that book there, the small book there. Each volume, they're probably like 100 volumes right now.
Okay.
But you can buy one volume and that'll cover you for a whole month. It's like a volume a month.
And you recommend it?
I do. I think it's very good because it, it's systematic. It's Chumash, Mishnah, Halacha, a little inspiration, some commentary on the Siddur, and you could actually do that in 15 minutes. It's kind of a 15 or 20 minute chunk. It's called the Daily Dose in Torah. You can check it out because, as I say, there are like probably right now 200 books. You can buy one book for probably $5. And see if you like it. If you like it, then you can keep on buying them as you want, and the like. So you got to find these avenues. It is important, obviously, that you connect with a synagogue of some sorts, whether it be a campus shul or a shul in your community, and that you develop a connection with a rabbi, a physical rabbi, that you can turn to. Now, all of us here in Israel are very, very happy to, you know, continue to correspond by email or phone, and for sure, I myself get many, many emails from different people, and I know the other rabbis do as well.
Can you share your email?
Yeah, my email is, I'm not a judge, but this is my email, judge5, J-U-D-G-E, the number 5, at AOL.com. I'm one of the last AOL people in the world, I think.
Can we call you?
Of course. I'll give you my cell phone number also. It's 052, you know, it's 011-972-52, 762-0675.
Can you just repeat that one more time?
Yeah, so it's 011-972. From America, it's 52-762-0675.
So there's no 052?
When you're calling from America, it's not 052. If you're calling from Israel, it's 052. That's the right. When you call a long distance from America, you take out that zero. And again, I want to repeat: this is not just a fake statement. You know, certainly all of us are very, very happy to stay in contact with you and correspond. But at the same time, it is good to have a flesh and blood person that you can talk to as well. Because I know we like Facebook and everything, we're so used to virtual communities, but it's also good to have a flesh and blood presence as well. And let me say something else. Shabbos is, of course, special, no matter where you are. But, ironically, when you're not going to be in a yeshiva environment, you got to make Shabbos more special. Because in some ways, you know, you could say the whole week is kind of like Shabbos. Not exactly. You know, you're learning, you're studying, you're davening. But when you're going to be in an environment where most of the week and most of your hours, you're not going to necessarily be serving Hashem in religious ways. So when Shabbos comes, you got to carve it out and make it very, very special in some ways. Shabbos is important to all of us, but Shabbos is even more important when you're going back to Chutz La'aretz than it would be even in Israel. So Shabbos has to be a time of rejoicing, of singing, of dancing, of eating, of sleeping, to be sure, but also of studying Torah, because you have extra time to study Torah. So you've got to use it. And then Shabbos, in turn, energizes the week. See, Shabbos, once again, is not simply a nice experience for Shabbos. It carries you over. That's why they have that bumper sticker. We also believe TGIF. Thank God it's Friday. But I think for a different reason, perhaps, than the people who intended the bumper sticker. Thank God it's Friday, not because, oh, now I can get drunk and fool around, but thank God it's almost Shabbos, and I'm going to get that spiritual high that I need to get.
At what place do we think about like wearing a kippah all the time or keeping kosher? Is that like...
Yeah, so again, those are very, very excellent questions. You know, I will tell you that, you know, I graduated law school a real long time ago. I graduated law school in 1979. So I began applying for jobs, 78, whatever it is, even summer jobs, you know. So this was a discussion, you know, do I wear a kippah for an interview? Do I not wear a kippah? No, halachically, yarmulke is a very negotiable thing, in truth. In other words, halachically, many religious people didn't wear yarmulkes and the like, or kippahs, you know. It's not like kosher. Kosher is actually a different issue.
Right.
So I have to say, and I'm telling you this, you know, with some embarrassment, that I went to some interviews without a kippah. Well, I'm not sure why it helped me. I still had a beard, but okay. I guess beards people have. And every interview I went without a kippah, I didn't get a job offer. And those I went with a kippah, I got a job offer. I thought God was telling me something. And part of the message is that, you know, this is the positive side of the pluralistic society and multicultural society America has become. Meaning, in many, many ways, multiculturalism has been a destructive phenomenon. You know, the rise of Islamic this and that. But In one way, it's been fairly good for the Jews, because now there is a greater recognition of diversity, and as a result, wearing a yarmulke in the workplace, a yarmulke or a kippah in the workplace, is not as strange or bizarre as it once was. You even see on TV shows sometimes. You ever notice on TV shows, they just sometimes have people wearing yarmulkes, and you know, they don't. The show is not about them. It's not even pointing them out. They're just part of the overall culture. So I can tell you, you know, having worked in law firms and having worked in law schools, that a kippah is really not a problem at all. And I think it's a point of pride. And it also reminds you that if you're wearing a kippah, you got to be sure you're on your best behavior. Now, that's the one downside. The one downside is this. If you feel that your behavior is going to be bring discredit on the Jewish people,
like if you don't keep kosher, like if you have your kippah and you walk into a McDonald's.
That's correct. If you're going to do a sinful behavior, you don't wear a kippah. That's right. You do not walk into a McDonald's with a yarmulke on. If you're going to an X-rated movie, or you're going to a prostitute, you don't wear your yarmulke. I agree with you. That is correct. But at the same time, it also works the other way. If you're wearing a yarmulke, you're less likely to go into the McDonald's. You're less likely to go into the X-rated movie. You're less likely to go into the press. That is the importance of this type of dress. People say, why is it important to dress a certain way? Because dress kind of reminds me not to cross certain boundaries. Now, once again, kosher, I'll go back to the same thing. I hope all of you will be able to keep kosher. If you are from New York, there's absolutely no problem in keeping kosher. You can, New York is better than Jerusalem in terms of being able to keep kosher. If you're from a smaller area or an area with less religious Jews, kashrut may be a problem. But once again, I want to remind you that half is better than none. Meaning, if you have to have some cheeseburger once a day, then don't have it twice a day. It's not healthy anyway. Meaning, or you can say my breakfast will be kosher or my lunch will be kosher. Never have the attitude, if I don't do it 100%, I might as well not bother. Every time, if there are two candy bars and one has an OU and one does not, and you choose the OU, you're doing a mitzvah at that time, even if you're going to eat treif meat or whatever it is. In fact, I'll even tell you, there was a very, very great rabbi who unfortunately had a son who became totally non-religious. And I don't want to mention the rabbi's name because it was a little bit of an embarrassment to Lashon Hara on him. His son actually became a very, very famous professor. He became an internationally renowned mathematician, but he was totally not religious. His father begged him, when you eat non-kosher meat, eat beef instead of pork. Which means even in the world of non-kosher, there are levels. Meaning, non-kosher beef that was not slaughtered is treif, but it's not as bad as pork and shellfish. Right? So you might say, what type of, that's stupid. I mean, I don't keep kosher. What's the difference? The answer, even that is the difference. Meaning, you try to do what you can do. That's really my message to you. But as I say, Shabbos will be your lifeline, and learning Torah on a regular basis will be your lifeline. Because that's going to connect you to the ultimate power source of Hashem. And then the mitzvah will cause you to do more mitzvahs and the like. And indeed, although it costs money, every time you get a week or so, come down to Israel. We will set you up with learning. Or Sameach and other places as well. Or Sameach is great, and other places are great too. We do short term as well as long term. Meaning, if somebody is here for a week or for a day, we will arrange learning and chavrusas for that week or for that day. So part of the way you grow spiritually is also to kind of emotionally connect to Eretz Yisrael. That even when you're not here, you're kind of still connected, you're thinking about coming back. We have people, isn't there? People I've been seeing for years and years and years, and they kind of come back. They're graduated college, they're working, but they kind of make a point of like showing up a few days every year to kind of reconnect. Because, your yeshiva is your spiritual home. And even if your physical home is somewhere else, but if the yeshiva is in your heart, if Eretz Yisrael is in your heart, you're still connected. Mm-hmm. And that carries you over very, very difficult points. Now let me just mention a few things. You know, this will overlap with other things I've said, but I think there'll be something new here. You know, we are in the weeks of Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? These Torah readings are talking about the Exodus. And I mentioned before a number of times that the word Mitzrayim has a double meaning. Mitzrayim is Egypt, but remember that Mitzrayim also means limits, constraints, and constrictions. And Kabbalistically, when we talk about the Exodus from Mitzrayim, we are not only referring to the Exodus from the land of Egypt and that particular slavery, but God enables us to become liberated from that which constricts and constrains and limits us. There is a Mitzrayim of the soul. That Mitzrayim can be egotism, selfishness, arrogance, cruelty, depression, lack of hope. These are enslavers, but these are not external enslavers. These are internal enslavers. But the idea is that when God liberated the Jews from Egypt, He put into the world a power of being liberated from enslavement. That's a spiritual force. And if I can connect to that force, I can become liberated from that which enslaves me. You understand that idea?
Sure.
This is the koach meaning the power of redemption that God put into the world as a result of the Exodus. Now, seen in that way, when you look at the ceremony that is probably the single most observed ritual in the Jewish community, and that is the Passover Seder. Like almost everybody has a Seder, but maybe it's not a kosher Seder and the like, but everybody has something. So amazing how the Seder, what are the two, I guess the three most, well, okay, four actually, more than you think. I would say there are four rituals that even very, very assimilated Jews try to keep in one way or the other. One is circumcision for boys. The second is some fasting on Yom Kippur. Maybe not the whole day, but some fasting. The third is lighting Hanukkah candles. Part of that is because of the Christmas competition, but Shabbos candles not, but Hanukkah candles. Yeah, and the fourth is the Passover Seder. I would think if we had to make a list of rituals that almost, not everybody, almost all Jews keep, that would probably be your list of four. Now again, except for the bris, which is probably kosher, all the other ones, maybe Chaya, bris and Chanukah are probably done properly. Pesach, Seder, and Yom Kippur may not be done totally properly, but they're observed by everybody. But everybody has a Pesach Seder. So when you look at the Pesach Seder, there are two things you're looking at. You're looking at the historical study of the Exodus, but metaphorically, see, there's a double message here. Metaphorically, you're looking at the journey of how I liberate my soul from that which enslaves it. You see, there is the literal and there's the metaphorical. Now, this is not to say, as some people say, that the Exodus of Egypt is only a metaphor. God forbid. Jewish belief affirms that the Exodus is a historical event. But the historical event itself is a metaphor. See, this is an important difference. We're not saying it's not history, it's only metaphor. We're saying it is history. But history itself is a metaphor for a higher reality. And therefore there's a double message. So what I want to do in the time I have is I want to go through some steps of the Seder and show you how it's relevant to our own personal liberation from that which enslaves us. And I'm going to mention four or five quick elements of the Seder. I'm sorry, did I get it? Okay, yeah. Element number one is we know that a very, very important part of the Seder is a question and answer format. One does not fulfill their obligation if you simply give an answer. There have to be questions. Now, the standard format of the questions are, of course, the four questions. Do any of you ask the four questions at a Seder? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, why is this night different than all other nights, etc.? But the truth of the matter is, if you look in the Gemara, the Manish Tana is really cheating. It's like Cliff Notes. Because in the ideal Seder, you're supposed to bring your own questions, and they are to be discussed. But if you don't have any questions, so we give you the questions. I remember years ago, I was once a guest at somebody's Seder. It's really funny in retrospect. And the kids, they were asking all these questions. And the father was very impatient because he wanted to start the Seder. So the father said, "Stop asking all these questions, we got to start the Seder." But you see how that's missing the point? The whole Seder is supposed to be, ask your questions. What is that lesson for us? If you want to be spiritually liberated, you got to ask questions. All questions are welcome. Now, there's a difference, however, between a question with a question mark and a question with an exclamation point. You understand that sometimes when people ask questions, they're not really asking questions, they're making statements. And, you know, obviously that happens sometimes, people. And that sometimes can be hostile, that can sometimes be arrogant. But if a person truly wants to understand, there is no such thing as an illegitimate question. That's lesson number one. Judaism is about asking questions. Even a page of Gemara. What is a page of Gemara other than a series of questions, answers, refutations, more questions? Somebody once asked me, can a person say a Dvar Torah without a question? And every Dvar Torah always says some questions. Why can't you just say what your point is? Why do you ask questions? The answer is, that's exactly it. Judaism is about questioning to try to understand. But I do want to point out, one has to ask questions with humility, all of us. Because there are many people who are greater than us that have gone through these things. So that's step number one. Be a seeker of wisdom. Ask questions. In fact, it's very, very fascinating. What is the term? When a person is a great, great scholar of the Torah, he goes by the name Talmid Chacham. Right? You heard the phrase Talmid Chacham. Now, translate that literally. What is Talmid Chacham? Talmid Chacham actually means a wise student. Chacham would mean a wise person. Talmid Chacham means a wise student. So why would I call, like, the greatest rabbi, I would say, oh, wow, he's a great Talmid Chacham. That's almost demeaning, you know what I'm saying?
And be forever a student.
That's right. That's exactly it. That the sign of the greatest wisdom is you're still learning, you're open to questions, to new understandings. You never say, I arrive. You never say, I've made it. A questioner is perpetually seeking to understand. That is why questions are so important. Questions means I'm still in the process of learning and growing. You know, they tell the story about a famous rabbi. He wasn't famous then. When he was a young man, he was hired to be a rabbi in Springfield, Massachusetts. And he got fired a few months into his job because the president said, you're wasting the shul's electricity because you're studying at night. So the rabbi says, but I'm studying Torah. He says, that's the point. We thought we got a rabbi who finished his education. Why are you still studying? You know, etc. But obviously, you know, that's so absurd. You know, we've had rabbis who died well into their hundreds. In other words, 104, 105. And they would learn day and night, you know, for 70, 80, 90, 95 years. Always seeing new things in the Torah, new ideas in the Torah. And that's the notion of asking questions. Be a searcher of wisdom. Be a Talmid Chacham. You know, I once heard a famous professor who loved to talk. He once said, until I was 20, I had to listen. From 20 onwards, I talk. But again, one learns by listening, etc., and absorbing. So that's lesson number one, ask questions. Lesson number two is there are three symbolic foods. Well, there's four cups of wine. There's more than that, but the Torah requires, the four cups of wine is rabbinic. The Torah requires the eating of three symbolic foods at the Passover Seder. The bitter herbs, whether it's horseradish or romaine lettuce, the matzah, and in the time of the temple, we don't have that today, we would eat the paschal lamb, which is called the Korban Pesach. Now, other foods are of rabbinic origin. I mean, as they say, the four cups of wine is a rabbinic takana because of four promises of redemption that God made to Moses. And the charoses, which is the apples and the wine, that's to remind us of the mortar and the salt water, the tears. Those are rabbinic. But the three big ones that the Torah requires are the bitter herbs, the matzah, and the Korban Pesach. Now here, there is an important symbol here as well. What is Maror? Maror is designed to remind us of the bitterness of our slavery. Why do we need to be reminded? So this is also an important step. One of the most important steps you must take towards spiritual redemption, spiritual freedom, is to honestly acknowledge the slavery that you're in. Until a slave admits to himself that he's a slave, he cannot take steps to become free. Meaning, look into your life. Identify, be honest to yourself. What do I need to correct? Am I too selfish? Do I have a temper problem? Do I need to be more compassionate? That's tasting the bitterness. Acknowledge what needs to be corrected in a relationship, in a personality. Because until you acknowledge that you're a slave, you cannot take the steps to be liberated. That's why tasting the bitter herbs is a necessary step in achieving freedom and liberation. Now, I remember, those of you that know the Maryland area, I lived in Silver Spring, Maryland, and I taught a law school in Baltimore. So the way you get from Silver Spring, Washington, to Baltimore is you go on 95, and you have to go 95 north. But when you go on 95 north, when you leave the Washington Beltway, there's a turnoff for 95 south, which goes into Virginia. So I remember I had to go to class once. I was driving from Silver Spring to Baltimore, and I had just moved, so I really didn't know the roads that well. And the turnoff was in the right lane, so my mind was wandering. So apparently I got onto 95 south, and I'm driving automatic pilot, and all of a sudden I start seeing the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, which I had never seen before on the way to Baltimore. So I had this sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. Am I on the wrong road? But I didn't want to acknowledge that I was on the wrong road because I really didn't know how to get back on the right road. So I can't even explain this. It makes no sense. But what I was doing is I kept on saying to myself, well, you know, maybe I just never noticed that when you go on 95 north, you see these things. In other words, I didn't want to admit that I was on the wrong road because it would be too hard to correct my course. So with some type of magical thinking, I thought to myself, well, maybe if I just keep on going, it'll, you know, turn into the right road. Well, that is the case because, you know, 95 ends at Florida, and at Key West, all you have to do is make a U-turn and you can go north again, right? So the problem is I would have been pretty late for class to drive all the way to Florida. But Again, I admit this makes no sense. On the other hand, I don't think it is so different than the games we often play to ourselves. Of keep on going and maybe it'll change. But what do they say the definition of an idiot is? An idiot is somebody who does the same thing over and over again and expects there to be a different result. Although in quantum mechanics that can happen. Okay. But in normal life it doesn't happen that way.
Insanity.
And the like. That's insanity. That's right. Yeah, right. That definition of insanity. So, Maror says, be honest. Taste the bitterness. If something isn't working, admit it to yourself. And then you can make the changes that need to happen. Don't just hold on. Things don't get better by themselves. Now, we then come to matzah. Now, we know the story of matzah. Right? The Jews were baking bread the morning of the Exodus. And they thought they'd have time to let the dough rise. It only takes 18 minutes. But what happened was, the Egyptians came in and said, get out now. But it's not just the Egyptians. God himself said, get out now. Because there's a tradition that says that spiritually, we were on the 49th level of impurity. And if you hit level 50, you're irredeemable. If we would have stayed in Egypt another second, I don't even understand that, would have been gone. So we had to bake our matzah, bake our dough, when it had not yet risen. Because we had to leave that second. So to commemorate the need for our leaving that second, that's why we eat matzah on Pesach. Right? You know, this is what the Torah says. It is a commemoration of the chipazon. Chipazon is the hurriedness. Now here is what matzah reminds us of. Matzah, if maror, is the cognitive awareness of what I need to change in my life. Matzah is the imperative of taking decisive action. Because the difference between matzah and chametz is only a matter of time. If you mix water and flour and do nothing, it'll become chametz automatically. Chametz is what happens when there's inertia. Matzah is created by taking action. Chametz is what happens naturally. Matzah is what happens when you bake it, you take action. So here's the thing, you know, in psychology, classical psychology is psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is based on insight, understanding yourself. Now, understanding yourself is a very important point, to understand every birth trauma that you had, and pre-birth trauma, and preconception trauma, and the history of every bowel movement, etc. But people can stay in psychoanalysis for many, many years, and they know the ins and outs of every little thing that ever happened to them. But until they take action to change, this is the difference between psychoanalysis and behavioral therapy. Behavioral therapy stresses the idea, just do it. So in a sense, the maror represents the insight in what I need to change, what is dysfunctional or negative in me. The matzah says, take action. Don't just sit on it, but take decisive action. Because otherwise, insights come and go. And once again, here the point basically is that spiritual elevation can be concretized only by some action, no matter how small. You know, they say there was a brilliant American academic, Robert Hutchins, who was the president of the University of Chicago, and he, as a young man, he was like 23, and he was the president. He was younger than some of the graduate students in the university. And apparently he was not so conscientious in taking care of his physical self, as we know that. And somebody once said to Dr. Hutchins, you know, why don't you exercise or run or jog a little bit more? So he said, well, you know, every once in a while, I really do get the urge to go to the gym. But I know if I lie down for a few moments, the urge will just pass. So I don't let it bother me. I just wait until it goes away. And spirituality is very much the same way. Every once in a while, a person gets very inspired maybe a Shabbat Friday night, or a Haggadah ceremony, or a Passover Seder, or Yom Kippur, or a JLE trip in Eretz Yisrael. And you really get inspired. But if you don't concretize it by action, the inspiration goes away. That's what the Alter Rebbe taught. So matzah is the lesson. Seize the moment. Carpe diem. Morar is to be honest in acknowledging what I need to correct. Matzah is taking the action to correct it. And then our final step is the Korban Pesach, which unfortunately, because there's no temple, we do not have the Korban Pesach today. But the Korban Pesach is a very interesting Korban because you have to bring it with other people. Even if you have a big appetite and a small lamb and you can finish the whole thing by yourself, the halacha is you either bring it with your family, or if you don't have a family, you must connect with another group and be part of a group. You cannot bring the Korban Pesach in isolation. And the lesson for that is, in our journey towards spiritual freedom, we need to have a community that shares those values. For some, they may have the good fortune that it might be their family, their parents, their siblings, at some point in their life, husband and wife. But for those who don't necessarily have a family, for those who don't have a family that shares those commitments, so you have to create, not to the exclusion, by the way, it's very important that you have a loving relationship with your family. God forbid, I am not at all suggesting cutting off connections. A religious Jew builds bridges. A religious Jew does not sever connections. You open doors, you don't close doors. But you also have to find a supplementary family of people who have the same goals, who strive for growth. That's the lesson of the Korban Pesach. So the bitter herbs is honesty in recognizing what within me needs to be liberated. Matzah, take action to concretize the inspiration. Korban Pesach, find a community of friends in which you help each other. You know, Maimonides writes that there are three types of friends. You know, Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avos says, you should have a friend. The Rambam says, there are three good things about friendship. The first is pragmatic. If I have a flat tire in the middle of the night, or I lost my keys, it's good to have somebody to call. If I don't have friends, who do I call when my car breaks down? So we'll call that the pragmatic part of friendship. A person's all alone. Yeah, so you might be fine when there are no emergencies in life. But what are you going to do when you need somebody? You have nobody to turn to. We'll call that pragmatic friendship. The second aspect of friendship is social. We are social creatures. It's good to have somebody to talk to, shoot the breeze, have a good time with. And the Rambam says this is a legitimate aspect of friendship, that we need and we relish the company of others. Some people more, some people less, some people are more extroverted, some people are introverted, some people like crowds of friends, some people only want, you know, one friend. But people need that connection. But the Rambam says, although the pragmatic and the social are important, and he's not disparaging them, they are not the deepest and most meaningful level of friendship. The deepest and most meaningful level of friendship is spiritual friendship, in which each person helps the other person become closer to God. Each person helps the other person become a better person. Now that friendship is not always an easy friendship, because that friendship may sometimes involve, if I see my dear friend doing something that's not quite good, I love him enough that I can talk to him about it. And he can talk to me. And in fact, in the best marriages, That's a very deep level of marriage as well, in which you're not just the yes person to the other one, but you're actually able to make the other person better as they are able to make you better. That's not kind of I'm okay, you're okay. That's a much deeper, complex, richly textured level of friendship. But the Rambam says that is the ultimately highest level of friendship. The friendship of spiritual fellowship. And that is merumaz, that is alluded to in the Korban Pesach, where you need to be connected in doing mitzvahs. That's why you'll sometimes find that the people you study Torah with will become your deepest friends, because you're both focused on such an important, elevating goal. Yeah, of course, you know, we need friends to kill time with sometimes. But the deepest friendships will be those that are connected to meaning. So, as I say, you guys are going back, and in a way, instead of leaving Mitzrayim, maybe you're going back to Mitzrayim. But you need to know that a Jew that is liberated from Mitzrayim can even be in Mitzrayim and be liberated. Because Mitzrayim is a state that is within you much more than it is a state without you. And you can be liberated as our forefathers and foremothers were liberated even when they were in Auschwitz and Treblinka. Because they remained connected to God in the greatest darkness of life. And so too with Baruch Hashem, your situation is not going to be that extreme. That you should also remain connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and liberated, tap into the power of the Exodus. And you will be freed and liberated from all the inner Mitzrayims that enslave you. So it was a pleasure having you. And again, please feel free to contact me or any of the Rebbeim. We love to help you in any way you can. May Hashem be with you at all times. Remember, our sages have taught us that the pathway that you want to go is the pathway that God will lead you. You want to serve Hashem, He will put the opportunities in your life to enable you to do so. If God forbid you don't, then those opportunities are not going to materialize. It all depends on you. You control your fate. You control your connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. May Hashem help you all to make the right choices in life. And come back soon.
You've been so inspirational. It's such a pleasure to listen to
you. The center for the Rosh Hashanah, I just see some new press with the